Now back to Paul Harris on the Big 550 KTRS.
Finally, Mrs. Secretary, in February 2003, you placed your enormous personal credibility before the United Nations and laid out a case against Saddam Hussein, citing...
No, they can't use it. They're editing it.
He's still asking me questions. Yeah.
He was not.
Jim, I'm sorry I lost you.
I'm right here, Mr. Secretary. I would hope they would put you back on camera. I don't know who did that.
We really...
I think that was one of your staff, Mr. Secretary. I don't think that's appropriate.
Emily, get out of the way. Bring the camera back, please. I think we're back on, Tim. Go ahead with your last question.
Thank you very much, sir. In February of 2003, you put your...
That is Tim Russert, two Sundays ago on his show Meet the Press, interviewing Secretary of State Colin Powell and being interrupted by one of Mr. Powell's aides, Emily Miller, in the midst of an interview, which I guess was running just a little bit over. And Ms. Miller jumped in to tell the secretary, we're done here. We have to move on to somebody else. Tim Russert, the host of Meet the Press, is also the author of a brand new book called Big Russ and Me, number 9 on Amazon.com today. And I'm happy to welcome him back to the Paul Harris Show. Hello, Tim.
Hey, Paul. How you doing?
Now, we're not going to get interrupted at all today, are we?
It was quite a day. You know, they were on the ground there, and they said to our producer in her earpiece, okay, wrap it up, which always means in our profession, go to the final question. So I said, finally, Mr. Secretary, and I asked him about his presentation before the UN about weapons of mass destruction. And suddenly, she caused the camera to move. And I did not know what had happened. At first, my heart stopped. I thought, a terrorist attack? Who knew?
Mm-hmm.
And then I heard her talking to Secretary Powell, and in credit to the general, he overrode her and said, wait a minute, put that camera back on me. I want to answer that question.
Yeah.
and he did, and he made a lot of news, actually, because he said he was unhappy and disappointed that his testimony may have not been accurate.
Right. And then later he apologized to you for the incident, is that right?
Yeah, he said, I'm sorry for the glitch. And I said, you know, because there had first been a lot of thinking that it was done for editorial reasons. They were trying to censor the question or avoid answering it. He said it was strictly time. And, I've been doing this 13 years, and I've never had anyone pull the plug. They say, wrap it up, and we say, all right, finally, here's the last question.
Although I do have to say, Tim, I thought you got a little bit carried away when you told Lloyd Grove, a taxpayer-paid employee interrupted an interview, not in the United States of America. That's not supposed to go on. This is attempted news management gone berserk.
Yeah, because after the interview, she called our producer and dressed her down, saying that we had no right to ask that question. And I thought at the time that it was attempted censorship.
I see.
And, when I found out it was simply time concern, I said to the secretary, I understand, and let's move on.
I got you. Now, I'll tell you what's funny about this. And I said this the day after it happened because I played the audio on my show. And it's funny that you wrote a book about your dad called Big Russ and Me, because that, to me, seemed like a dad moment. Because the tone in the secretary's voice when he said, Emily, get out of the way. Bring the camera back around. That was everybody's dad when they're just annoyed. And it's like, get out of the room. Go to your room. You know, get out of the way. I'm watching TV. Get out of the way. Whatever that was.
Yeah. I mean, someone had told me they were thinking of making T-shirts. Emily, get out of the way.
You know? All right. Now, before we move on to other things, one other kind of frivolous thing I got to ask you about.
Sure.
How'd you like being on Jeopardy?
That was my second time, and it's nerve-wracking. But what they do is they get you on there by saying, okay, here's what we're going to do. We'll give $20,000 to your favorite charity. So I get $20,000 for the Boys and Girls Club of Washington, D.C., which is something that's very special to me.
Yep.
But then if you hit the clicker before the question is fully completed, you lock yourself out. And it's so damn frustrating because you know the answer and you're hitting the clicker and then you can't do it. I much prefer asking questions on Meet the Press to the President of the United States or John Kerry than being up there making a fool of myself.
I think sometimes Trebek elongates the last word just to catch some people.
Those Canadians.
All right, let's talk about something serious. Let's talk about Iraq for just a moment here.
Sure.
Who is going to lead this country when we hand it over to them on June 30th? Do we have any idea?
No. I asked Paul Bremer that exact question about a month ago. Who do we turn the keys over to? And he said, that's a good question. No one knows. Mr. Brahimi, the UN delegate there, is trying to cobble together a group of people. But the problem is what's happening on the ground in Iraq, not just with the insurgency, but in the minds of the Iraqi people. There's a Gallup poll out today which says that 70% of them think that their lives would be threatened if they're seen as associating themselves with the United States.
Mm.
And how do we put together a government of well-meaning people who won't be perceived as puppets of the U.S., and how do we guarantee the security of them and the security of the nation of Iraq? It's really complicated. And I've talked to Democrats and Republicans privately over the last 2 weeks, and nobody knows a good way out.
And here's the thing that worries me the most. If we're going to literally give them democracy, which means they can choose whoever they want, majority rules, etc., what do we do, Tim, if Iraq becomes a Muslim theocracy and you've got a Taliban-like government in there?
Exact question, again, that I posed to Secretary Paul, Secretary Rumsfeld, Vice President Cheney, President Bush, all of them. What if the Iraqi people choose something less than Jeffersonian democracy? And they very well might.
I mean, they could say, okay, you know what? We're going to put Muqtada al-Sadr at the top of the pyramid here.
Yeah. Have a Shiite radical Islamic state here. And what have we achieved? Or what if the Iraqis decide, you know what? We want to have a Shiite republic and a Sunni republic and a Kurd republic. The concern is this. Everyone believed their weapons of mass destruction, even the French, the Germans, the Russians who opposed the war. Former President Clinton, Democrats, Republicans all said weapons of mass destruction. We haven't found them. And either they didn't exist, there's a colossal intelligence failure, or they're hidden, or they've been transported someplace else. None of those is a good result. Secondly, if we say we're there to try to bring about a democracy, and in the end the Iraqi people don't want that, the concern that Republicans expressed to me last week is that can we create another potential haven for terrorism, another Afghanistan from the 80s and 90s, which would have its sights on Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Israel? It's a real mess. It really is. And I think everyone's got to come together, the best minds available, to try to work through this, because it is complicated.
How much of this falls on the shame of dealing with Ahmed Chalabi?
When history is written, I believe his role will be very extremely significant. He convinced Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, he met with the Vice President, he met with Rumsfeld, and he said that it is all in the public domain, that we would need only 30,000 American troops in Iraq, that he would bring them to find the weapons of mass destruction, and that we would be greeted as liberators. Some of the exiles he knew said that we'd be given flowers and chocolates. None of that has proven to be true. None of it. His organization has received $20 million in U.S. taxpayer money over the last 2 years, $30 million since the year 2000. He was on the payroll for $350,000 a month until last week. And now he's persona non grata. It is just an extraordinary change of fortunes for him. But the fact is, it was his views and his insights that were very instrumental in putting together the thinking of many people in the administration.
I think he was the central figure in all of it. And what's ironic to me is that now that he's been discredited, isn't it his son who's overseeing the trial of Saddam Hussein?
Yeah. You know, and he hasn't lived in Iraq since 1958. He lived in London.
So how does he expect the Iraqis to rally around him when most of them weren't alive when he was last there?
When we rolled into Baghdad so successfully militarily, we were all cheering. He was airlifted in with 400 troops, and he told people that he'd be Spartacus, that Iraqis would rally behind him and follow him in a march to Baghdad. Instead, they jeered him.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so painful when you go back and recreate all this. You just shake your head.
Talking with Tim Russert from Meet the Press and his book, Big Russ and Me, here on the Paul Harris Show on the Big 550 KTRS. Tim, did the media overplay Abu Ghraib?
I think it's important that we show what went wrong if the United States government's involved in it. But I also think we also have to show the beheading of Nick Berg and also our troops who are charred and hung from a bridge. I don't think there's any moral equivalency between the United States of America and the terrorist. But the Republicans I've talked to, John Warner and John McCain and Lindsey Graham, this is their view, that we should get everything out about Abu Ghraib and just say, okay, this happened. It's not the way we conduct ourselves. It's not the way of the United States military. My dad, Big Russ, was in World War II. I spent a lot of time with a lot of his buddies who were POWs. And the one thing they said to me over and over again is that we do not treat our prisoners the way the Germans and Japanese treated me, talking about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we are able to deal with this in a bipartisan way as a nation, then we can go to the world and say, this is how you do it. When people do something wrong, we find the few who are responsible or follow up the chain of the command, whatever the case may be, and take steps to make sure it never happens again. Now, could we ask you in other parts of the world, for example, in the Arab world, could we ask you about your outrage about Nick Berg and the Americans dragged through the streets and hung from a bridge? Could we ask you to join with us in trying to correct those atrocities? And if we're going to have a moral authority and a moral voice in the world, I think we have to be seen as a nation that deals with problems when they occur and deals with them in an effective way, and that's what we're trying to do in Washington.
I didn't hear nearly enough outrage from the Arab world, although I thought it was funny that both Hamas and Hezbollah said that the Nick Berg beheading was inhuman. And
yeah.
I thought, you're the people who are strapping bombs to teenage girls and sending them into discos. You know,
right.
Inhuman is a different scale for you guys.
Paul, that's a great point. You know, I asked Colin Powell in the palm tree interview, but I asked him about the Arab outrage, and he said, you're right, it hasn't been heard. And I said, why not? He said, I wish I knew the answer to that. And no one knows the answer. And why isn't there an Arab democracy? What is it? And we have to think about that.
Yep.
We really do.
Absolutely.
Okay.
By the way, as bureau chief for NBC News there in Washington, how mad were you that CBS got the Abu Ghraib photos and you didn't?
Well, we never like to get beaten on any story. But you got to do it right, and you got to put it in context. And when I found out what happened, those pictures came from the family of one of the National Guardsmen who was accused of doing improper things in prison. He was afraid they were being set up. They were going to take a fall.
Yep.
And their argument is that, you know, the hoods and the dog leashes weren't government issue in their National Guard bag, and that they were authorized or enabled to do this. And that's where they came from.
Yeah. See, if it were me and the competition did that, I'd be jealous, but I'd also be psyched knowing I have a show this week.
Right.
We have something to talk about.
Yeah.
All right. Now let's get to the book, Big Russ and Me, the story of you and your dad. Your dad didn't really have a lot of time for you because he was working two jobs, and on the weekend, you know, you talk about him resealing the driveway and all this other sort of stuff. How did you guys form a bond when he was barely there?
Well, my dad is somebody who grew up in the Depression, left school in 10th grade, went in the war, and been involved in a terrible plane crash and spent 6 months in the hospital, and then came back and started, as you say, a second mission to raise and educate his four kids by working 30 years as a truck driver in a garbage man. And I learned by his example, the quiet eloquence of his hard work. Didn't say much, but I saw the level of sacrifice he was making for us. And my mom reinforced that. She would say, you know, Dad wants to be here, but he's off working. And I knew he wasn't at the tavern or the racetrack. And when he was there, he would always say, you know, how you doing? He made a point of signing our report cards, and he understood that he was giving up something by working two jobs. But he was also enabling us to live in a house and have a station wagon and do the things that we wanted to do as a family.
Mm-hmm.
I learned from his example, but I also made a pledge to myself. You know, when I was at home plate in Little League and looked in the bleachers, and my dad wasn't there because he was working, I really remember saying to myself as I got older, if I'm ever blessed by being a father, that I'm going to do it differently. I'm going to be there at my kids' events in a big way, and I hope I have a job that allows me to do that. And it's, you know, legend at NBC that if Luke's got a game at 3 o'clock, I'm gone, and I'll come back at 5:30, and I'm on beeper, and they can always find me, but I'm never going to sacrifice that.
You mentioned your dad in World War II a few minutes ago. My dad served in the war as well, part of the Greatest Generation. He never wanted to talk to me about his experiences. Did your dad talk about World War II to you?
Never. I was on his back in the lake swimming one time, and I saw all the scars. I was about 5 years old. I said, Dad, what are all those scars? And he just dove back in the water and threw me off the way he always played games. And I asked my mom. She said, well, your dad was hurt in the war, but he won't talk about it. Finally, in high school, I was studying World War II, and I said, Dad, you got to talk to me about it. And he brought me down to the basement and pulled out this old yellow newspaper clip. October 27th, 1944, with a picture of the plane he was on, totally destroyed, and how he had been ejected in flames. And a young kid from Chicago named Billy Sajaki saved his life. And I've been able to recreate much of the accident, and I've talked to the brother of a pilot who was killed. I talked to Billy Sajaki. And my father's now learned more about the crash than he had known. And he's been a little bit more forthcoming, but he, you know, there's no introspection, there's no victimization. It's, I'm glad I went, we beat Hitler, But that's behind us, you know. And I had two jobs, and some guys couldn't have one. And I got four great kids, and let's go.
Did he look at the account that you wrote up and say, good job?
When I didn't show him the book until it was completed, bound and printed. And I said, Dad, this is it. Because he's the kind of guy, we'd sit around the kitchen table, he'd say, you know, whatever we say at the table doesn't leave the table. And we didn't say anything at the table other than, you know, pass the potatoes, please. But he, you know, he's just a private guy. But he took the book, and I sent it to him, and I didn't hear for a couple of days. And I got nervous. So I finally called him. He said, hey, I'm reading a chapter a day. You know, I'm not through yet. But it was all over. He said, thank you. He said, thank you for doing that. He brought back a lot of great memories. And I learned some things about the war I didn't know. And some things I knew, but I hadn't talked about or remembered in a long, long time. And I thank you. And Dad doesn't say thank you very often. You know, you give him a gift, he'll say thank you. But this is the first time for something like this. He said thank you for one Meet the Press when I did Dick Cheney from Camp David after the September 11th, and then the book.
Dads always want their sons or daughters to have a better life than they did, and you certainly have a better life than your dad did. You don't have to work two jobs. You don't have to bust your hump to do all these sort of things.
Right.
How did your dad react when your salary at NBC was printed in the newspaper several years ago? And I'm not going to say what your salary was because it's nobody's business, but it got printed in the paper, and it was more than your dad had ever made in his life.
Oh, God. I mean, actually, one time when I was working in the government, it was printed, I made $75,000. $75,000. I mean, he couldn't believe it. And he called me up and said, everybody I know is hitting me up for a loan. Yeah, and then came NBC. But he still ends every conversation on Monday morning after he does his analysis of Meet the Press. And I tell my political friends he's the cheapest and most accurate focus group anybody could ever have. But he concludes the conversation by saying, all right, take care. I still can't believe they pay you all this money to BS on the air.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, don't send me a car. You tried to give him, what was it, a Lexus?
I said to him, how about a Lexus, a Mercedes, a Cadillac? And I flew home. He got me in his old car, drove two blocks to Jack Atkins Ford. Said, Charlie, show him what I want, a black Crown Victoria.
Yep.
I said, Dad, it's a cop car. Charlie, open that trunk. Look at that trunk. You put a case of beer and a suitcase in there. Charlie, show him the spare. That's not a donut. That's a real spare. He said, Lexus, Mercedes. He goes, I beat those guys. I said, Dad, a Cadillac, American made. He said, I drive home in a big Cadillac. All the neighbors are going to say, Big Russ's kid makes it on TV. Now he's showing off. He goes, that's not who I am. I'm a Crown Vic guy. Even in receiving a gift, he taught me a lesson.
I got 30 seconds here. Is it true you once stalked Yogi Berra?
Did I ever? And I never got his autograph. I went to Cleveland, Ohio, Yankee doubleheader, 5 years of my life, never got near him. And now he's really become a very good friend of mine. He called me the other day, just wished me well. I love the stories about Yogi. They're all true. Walking in the pizzeria, you want your pizza cut in 6 or 8 slices? 6, I can't eat 8. And when I interviewed him the other day, Yogi, I said, Yogi, he said, I'm nervous. I said, don't be nervous. Whatever I ask, whatever comes to your mind, say it. He said, okay? He said, okay. I said, Mickey Mantle. He said, what about him?
Well, there's your St. Louis connection to Yogi Berra.
Big time.
And to this show, too. Thank you, Tim. Good luck with the book.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Tim Russert, author of Big Russ and Me, number 9 on Amazon.com. And, of course, every Sunday morning, he's on Meet the Press on NBC. And occasionally here on the Paul Harris Show. This is the Big 550 KTRS.